Welcome once again to the Think Christian podcast, where we like to say there's no such thing as secular even in popular culture. I'm Josh Larson. I'll be your host for this show. I also get to edit the articles at thinkchristian.net. Thanks for lending us your ears for the next 30 minutes or so. Our topic this week is spiritual warfare, and that's a phrase that conjures up images of exorcisms, battles with demons, you know, the head-spinning stuff. Some of that is biblically based. I mean, there are demons in the Bible, and Paul tells us in Ephesians that our struggle is against spiritual forces of evil. Well, in pop culture, that struggle can be depicted both on a grandiose scale, but also an intimate one. If you think about Netflix's Stranger Things, it often feels like an end times battle with those kids as warriors. But season 3 makes room for a personal experience of spiritual warfare as well. Then there's the new movie Midsommar, in which the spiritual warfare is all about the personal and the psychological. TC writers Claude Acho and Joe George will be breaking all that down with me. But before we do, would you mind leaving a rating or a review for the TC Podcasts on Apple Podcasts? Shouldn't take too long, and really, you've already given at least, what, 8 hours of your life to Stranger Things? Maybe toss 45 seconds and a kind word or two our way. Let's talk Stranger Things Season 3 with Claude Acho. Claude, how did you watch this thing? Did you binge it like my daughter and her friends, or were you more of the responsible adult who watched it in reasonable installments?
Little column A, little column B. My wife and my kids were away for a few days, and so I had just total rein on what to watch. And so I did, basically, I think I broke it up over 3 nights. And so just kind of treated like 3 movies. So kind of 2 installments here and there, and then one final big showdown to cap it off.
There you go. I did something similar. Yeah, because I think with 2 episodes, it's about 1.5 hours, maybe a little more. So a decent feature length. And of course, they're built to suck you in. So it's pretty hard to just do one. So yeah, I made it through the entire season myself. And for those who might be new to this series, basically Stranger Things set in the 1980s in this small town of Hawkins, Indiana. And the concept is that underneath Hawkins is the Upside Down. This is essentially a parallel universe of sorts where an evil force lurks that is seeking to escape into our world and pretty much consume it. And standing in the way of this is a group of nerdy kids. So think of The Goonies, which is just one of the show's many 80s touchstones. And those kids include Eleven, played by Millie Bobby Brown, who's a girl with psychokinetic powers. So we've got sci-fi, we've got fantasy, horror, all of this stuff going on here. And it really creates this atmosphere that I think matches some of our most dramatic visions of spiritual warfare. This evil force that's depicted is very much the way the devil is described in 1 Peter 5, verse 8, as a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. I also think that even the camera work has that predatory feel in a lot of the series. So I wanted to start, Claude, with that phrase itself, spiritual warfare. When you hear that, when people use that, what comes to mind for you?
Yeah, I mean, that's such a huge question. I think what comes to mind are a lot of questions, actually. I think there are sort of categories attached to spiritual warfare that I think are kind of related to popular culture, where you think of like exorcisms and sort of like these big moments of temptation. And then I think the more that I've thought about it and read and have grown and matured and thought about that in biblical categories, it seems like it's more insidious and more subtle, more sort of like something that attaches itself to the underside of things that I'm already kind of prone to move towards and then kind of pushes me towards deeper vices in those ways. So I've thought about spiritual warfare in sort of these big grand terms. But then, you know, I've sort of realized it's the underbelly of pride, sort of the underbelly of deep resentment. It's actually attached to things that are much more subtle and much more common to my day-to-day. And so I think it's just a really complicated topic, which is why I'm glad we're getting a chance to jump into it.
Yeah, those are kind of two polar opposite ends. And I think both can be true in a way. A lot of that imagery that has been taken over by popular culture is drawn from stuff we get in the Bible, like the verse I just mentioned. So that's definitely there. But you're right, in the everyday Christian's life, it's often experienced more in very personal struggle and psychological challenges. And so I think Stranger Things is an interesting combination in some ways of both of those polar ends of this. I think the series does something really interesting with the color red I wanted to touch on, because that is often the symbol of evil in pop culture. You know, when we're talking about spiritual warfare and we're seeing some of these more grandiose visions, red is definitely involved. It's probably the signature color of Stranger Things. This season has a lot of fun with it. I think of the neon hospital sign, where a number of scenes are set in the hospital. There's also the mall plays a huge part in this season. It's a new mall that's opened outside of Hawkins, and all those neon signs there, a lot of them involve red. And how about that moment where the corrupt mayor meets with a Russian agent? Yes, we didn't even mention that the Soviets are involved in this season, but they meet inside this carnival ride that has these red strobe lights. And of course, the red of the opening titles. I don't know about you, Claude, but for me, the opening titles are still the best thing about Stranger Things. That's the part I never want to skip. What do you like about how the show looks and sounds, Claude?
That observation about red really stands out. I think of the hospital scene where Nancy and Jonathan are sort of encountering the mind flayer, and they're sort of running and just get a lot of close-ups of her face and just sort of this look of complete helplessness in the face of kind of evil incarnate, right? This creature that we don't know a ton about, and just sort of this look, and she gets backed up into the wall, and the way that it's shot and then just up close, just all in her business, and we're there with her, it just feels really personal. And so I appreciate the way that they kind of construct those moments. And as somebody who doesn't gravitate towards anything that is remotely scary, the way that they do it, I feel invited into it. Like, it's not so frightening as to be off-putting, but they've also done the work to make me invest in the characters that I have to see it, even though those moments are things I would typically kind of recoil from.
You mentioned the mind flayer there, so we should probably get into that a little bit. Essentially, evil in Stranger Things almost always involves an infection of some kind. And in season three, the evil force, the kids do call it the mind flayer. That's their term for this force that's trying to infect our world, essentially. And in season three, it takes possession of Billy, played by Dacre Montgomery. Maybe, Claude, you could explain a little bit about who Billy is and what happens to him here.
Yeah, so Billy, previously, we've seen him as Max's, I guess, stepbrother, and he is just kind of a hotshot bully. I mean, there's no really other way to describe him. He's got the cool car. He looks cool. He's got the great hair, got the great little flaky mustache, got the gold chain. I mean, he looks really cool, but he's just a really cruel person. And this season, you know, without getting into spoilers, we find out some of the reason why that he has, you know, some of the tendencies that he has. But essentially, you know, he's being the hotshot that he is, trying to seduce some older ladies. En route to kind of doing that, he gets caught up by the mind flayer, just driving through Hawkins, and gets pulled into evil, totally unknown to him, and then becomes sort of the first of the flayed, a functioning agent for this force, and really is doing this without his own volition and will, but becomes a sort of agent of destruction as well.
Yeah, there's a back and forth there where, in a way, it lets loose Billy's worst tendencies, but there are also elements where you can see he's being forced to do things against his will. There's an interesting description by one of the younger kids, Will, played by Noah Schnapp. Will was infected by the Mind Flayer in season two, and so here, when they're watching Billy and figuring out what's going on, Will says, "The Mind Flayer likes to hide. He only used me when he needed me. It's like you're dormant, and then when he needs you, you're activated." So in that context, season three, it becomes a bit of a battle for Billy's soul, I think you can say. And there's this really interesting moment, you kind of touched on this, Claude, where Elle reads his mind. This is another power she has. And she witnesses this memory from Billy's childhood when he's on the beach with his mother. It begins as this really nice memory. I think he's surfing and they're enjoying their time together. But then as Elle walks along the beach toward this storm cloud she sees, she passes these more volatile memories from Billy's youth. And they show, as you suggested, how he became hardened by those experiences and then eventually abusive himself. So maybe you could talk a little bit more, Claude, about what you think the show might suggest or at least provoke us to think about when it comes to our own complicity when it comes to spiritual warfare. I mean, in the show, it's certainly an outside force, right? The mind flayer is identified. But it's also interesting that they choose Billy because he's a problematic character before he was infected, too.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I think there's one line that relates to this. It comes from Nancy's mom, who tries to console Nancy after she's in the newsroom trying to get her story picked up. And her mom sits with her, and it's a great scene. Her mom says, you know, the world has a way of just beating you down. And that's what we've seen happen to Billy, that the world has beat him down. And what has happened as part of that, and I think that fits with the view of the world in Stranger Things, where there are these forces of evil, and sometimes there are these monsters, but sometimes it's just the brokenness of life. And so Billy's been beat down through some family circumstances. And I think what happens in relation to that and the mind flayers, it does bring out the worst in him in some ways. But at the same time, you have these moments, that sauna scene, which is almost like an exorcism of sorts, right? Where they get him in, they heat the sauna to try to find out, is he really been taken captive by the mind flayer? And in that moment, you get Billy really having this confessional moment of, he made me do it. I don't want to do these things. Even I understand that there's lines that I would never cross. I wouldn't do this, is sort of the subtext behind that. And, you know, you see his stepsister, you see Max there, and just sort of the agony of viewing that. So I think there's some pretty creative, interesting things happening that show, well, Billy isn't fully complicit in this, but it is bringing out these things that have been in him to sort of an extreme. But even in those moments, he recognizes, like, I don't want to do this. Like, I'm doing things that I don't want to do, right? Which reminds us of, you know, famous words from the Apostle Paul in Romans.
For sure. Yeah, the tension for me in that scene is thinking, they're also wrestling with how much of this is the real Billy, but they could easily killed him in that sauna as the temperature rises. And so I think that's getting right at the heart of where our sympathies are conflicted within that character and with that scene for sure. You know, there's a verse in 2 Timothy 2 that I think illuminates this a little bit. I'm just going to quote from it here. It says, "Flee the evil desires of youth and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace, along with those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart." And then a bit later, "Opponents must be gently instructed, in the hope that God will grant them repentance, lending them to a knowledge of the truth." And here's the really applicable part. "And that they will come to their senses and escape from the trap of the devil, who has taken them captive to do his will." So there's a combination even there in that piece of scripture of being held captive in spiritual warfare, but I also think of being complicit in our own captivity. So I don't know if we can clearly answer one side or another on that. And maybe Stranger Things just helps to illuminate that difficulty.
I think so. And I think what's also interesting is you see the moment in the final episode, the way Billy is freed, is released, right, is with Elle speaking a word to him that really appeals to sort of this purity in him. The show wants us to point back to the moments of purity in his life. There's a lot there. And I think you're right. The show is obviously not seeking to come out and lay out all these allegories or answer all these questions, but really is illuminating some really interesting points of discussion.
And that moment between Elle and Billy, what I love about it, just to go back to the idea of color, is she actually calls out the details that there is a blue ribbon that Billy's mother is wearing in that memory, and that she's holding yellow sandals. No mention of red at all, because it's not really in that scene. It's kind of like taken out of that memory to just communicate to us that there's a purity there. Maybe we shouldn't get into where the series goes from there, because there is that climactic confrontation and something does happen with Billy beyond that. But we'll leave that perhaps for listeners who haven't binged season 3 yet to discover. Anything else you want to hit about your experience watching season 3, Claude?
Yeah, you know, I saw a piece from The Atlantic today talking about the importance of the mall in season 3, which I thought was really interesting, because it was looking at the mall as this point of connection where, you know, how you have all these different characters sort of finding their identity, finding their place. You have Steve and Robin building a great friendship that surprises us in some ways. You see Erica, you know, social media has its way, right? They loved Erica in previous seasons and now she's really prominent again. So social media always rules. But it was really sort of extolling the virtues of the mall as sort of this bonding place. But in relation to spiritual warfare, I thought it was really interesting that the mall is this location of immense evil, and just what that has to say about consumerism, and how the opening shot of season 3 is locals saying, you know, save our downtown, no mall, save our community. And it's the mall that brings all of this chaos and destruction. And so you could make some real reaches about critiques of consumerism that I'm sure someone's doing that. But I think there's something to that. I think there's something to the fact that the mall, which does bring really good things. I remember a lot of bonding moments at the mall, but it's also a place of immense consumerism, insecurity, all of these things. And that's the place and location center of a lot of evil in a really great, you know, communal town. So I think there's something there.
I think so too. I mean, that's the sort of personal spiritual warfare that we struggle with on a daily basis, I think, consumerism and those aspects of capitalism. So that's there. I will say, you know, if it doesn't feel completely followed through, the Duffer brothers, who created the series and write and direct a lot of it, I think they always lead with the 80s touchstones and then try to retrofit them to their story. And I do feel like The Mall is a little bit of that, you know, where they started with it. What's an 80s iconic element that we can use in season three? And somebody was like, oh, The Mall. Yeah, which is a good idea. But then they kind of retrofit the story around it because I just don't see like characters like Elle and Max, that whole dress makeover sequence. Like Max is sort of a skater kid who would have nothing to do with The Mall, right? She's kind of an outsider. So they almost force her to bring Elle to find the perfect clothes in The Mall. It's like these two wouldn't do this. But they just wanted to have that mall touchstone, so they kind of force it in there.
Yeah, I agree. Max would definitely be posted up at the arcade, if any place in a mall.
There you go. Claude, you're working on a piece on Stranger Things as well for the TC website. So I know you're finishing that up. It should be up by the time this episode goes out. So encourage listeners to check that out. And yeah, thanks for covering the Hawkins, Indiana beat for us.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
To let me know, should I stay or should I go? If you say that you are mine, I'll be here till the end of time. So you got to let me know, should I stay or should I go?
There may be no more common example of spiritual warfare in my life than that age-old question, should I stay? Or should I go? Should I stay in this situation, this relationship, this conversation? Should I go into this risky new place, this other direction, this place of risk? I doubt Mick and Joe and the rest of the Clash had all that in mind when they penned that 1981 classic, but when I first heard it, I was probably about 13, and I'll tell you the truth, spiritual warfare was one of the first things I thought of. Maybe it was the context of the album title, Combat Rock, maybe it was the way I was embracing a sort of punk aesthetic to my faith, but that line, it's always tease, 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 you're happy when I'm on my knees, always got me thinking. Hello, this is your resident DJ John J. Thompson, and that was, as always, just a taste of the special batch of songs I have curated for this episode of the Think Christian podcast. And since we got all dark with the Hail Satan episode just a few weeks back, I took a slightly different track with this list. I mean, don't get me wrong, Old Scratch certainly makes his presence known here, but this batch delves deep into the idea of struggle, conflict, war, and how we either win or lose those battles. We've got tracks from Rage Against the Machine, U2, David Byrne, 30 Seconds to Mars, Zach Brown Band, Grizz Folk, Avril Lavigne, Buddy Miller, Metallica, and a true spiritual warrior, if ever there was one, Johnny Cash, who you will hear from a bit later here on the podcast. To make sure you're armed and ready for battle, just search for the Think Christian playlist on Spotify and hit play. If you follow the latest episode playlist, you'll always have the newest one there in your browser, but you can also find each episode's playlist listed separately under the Think Christian profile. Plus, we combine all the playlists into one massive archive, so you can follow that as well. And as always, if you think of any great songs I should add, feel free to tweet at me at John J. Thompson, and I'll see what I can do. And that's it for now. But until next time, remember, when things get quiet, that's just your enemy reloading.
Let's talk to Joe George. Joe, I'd wish you a belated happy Midsummer, but you know, now that you and I have both seen Ari Aster's Midsummer, that doesn't quite have the same pleasant connotation, does it?
No, it does not. In fact, I'm away from all things Swedish now. I'm not going to IKEA, not watching Bergman movies. I'm done.
You've written off an entire country.
An entire country, yeah.
Maybe you can share with the audience a little bit of what goes on in this bonkers film, just enough so they know why we're scarred.
Oh, gosh. So it's the next movie by Ari Aster, who did Hereditary, and it's another exploration of grief in which we have a young woman named Dani, played by Florence Pugh, who suffers a great loss, and I won't go into much detail about this right now, at least. And her boyfriend, who is looking to get out of the relationship but is noncommittal, sort of begrudgingly takes her to this trip to Sweden with some college friends, including a Swedish exchange student, where they are celebrating a 9-day midsummer feast in which things start out as people will just say culturally different and then become horrifying or hilarious Depending on what mood you're in when you watch it, because my crowd laughed loudly during the climax. Oh, yes.
Well, quick question there at the start. And do you think they were laughing at it or with it? I mean, it's hard to tell because you're trying to get in the heads of the movie and the audience at the same time. But just reading the vibe of the room, what did you feel?
I think it's someplace in the middle of it. I mean, so I've seen it twice. Once with a full house, and then I watched it last night, and I was the only person in the theater. And I found myself kind of chuckling at some of the same points, you know? It's got that Texas Chainsaw thing where it's so horrific, it's almost absurdly funny in points, at least for me.
Yeah, laughter in a horror film often is a form of release. Well, you mentioned Hereditary, and, you know, in a lot of ways, I think that would be the more appropriate film to talk about in terms of spiritual warfare. That's the movie where you have a literal demonic possession, right? But I think that Midsommar touches on this too, and maybe in a way that we can personally relate to a little bit. It starts, as you mentioned, with this character, Danny, who is suffering from trauma, and then it goes on to show how she's not really loved at that time by those around her, particularly this boyfriend, Christian, played by Jack Rayner. He's a bit distanced from her, kind of stuck himself in a place of wanting to end the relationship, but not feeling he can do it while she's so vulnerable, but also not being brave enough or caring enough to be there for her in that moment. And that leaves this void. It creates this space for her where evil, really, though it's disguised as community in the form of this commune they meet, comes in to fill that void that she's experiencing. So it's an interesting move for Astor to make from the demonic possession that we eventually get in Hereditary to Midsommar, where what we have is something more earthbound, just as horrifying in a way, but more earthbound. I guess, were you surprised, Joe, that this film doesn't really involve the supernatural?
So I'm one of the few people who loves the last 15 minutes of Hereditary. So
you are. Interesting.
No, I'm full on board with that. So that said, I wasn't surprised or disappointed that it never got supernatural with that. There's enough evil for us to do by ourselves without the help of ghosts and demons that I was okay with that in this particular case. And I think you're spot on with it's doing that same sort of imaginative work. It's just keeping it on the earthy level, which is a really good word to use to describe what happens in this film.
Definitely. Yeah. So then how do we make that connection, do you think? How can we see Danny's dilemma if it doesn't involve this explicit spiritual realm? I think it still feels like a spiritual crisis. What ways do you think the movie gives you that sense?
Boy, well, you use this phrase that something fills the void for Danny when she goes out to this commune. And I think that's a perfect way to start thinking about it. She's looking for something throughout the entire film. And I think you touched on this beautifully in your piece for TC about it, about the open mouths of grief that happened in there. And we see this, at least for me most clearly, not in a part where she's got her mouth open, but early on, the first phone call she makes to Christian. And Astor shoots it as a long, unbroken take that's just Florence Pugh's face. And she's got Christian on the phone, and so we're hearing the phone conversation, and we're looking at her face, and she's clearly overcome with grief at this point. She thinks something's up with her family, but she hasn't gotten the bad news yet. And she's trying to talk Christian into at least just spending time with her. And you watch her kind of wipe this mask of happiness or satisfaction over her face while grief is seeping through. You know, the tears will start and then she'll brush them and the smile will come out. It's this really wonderful acting balancing act, but also just putting the emphasis on the face, which I think teaches us to watch the movie. There is so much where Danny in particular is looking at other people for something, usually some sort of empathy. And it's all shot reverse shot, that Silence of the Lambs style of we're watching their perspectives back. And so many times, nobody gives her anything. Or as you point out in your piece, they almost mimic it in a way that mocks it. And so for me to answer that question long, the spiritual warfare element is simply teaching us how to treat other people. Danny is a hurt and grieving and person who needs something, and she's putting that all out there in her face, and no character will respond to her in some way. And so she keeps having to mask and pile up.
Yeah, it brings it down to a personal level, I think. And Pugh is great in the performance. And that prologue, that whole extended prologue that is not set in Sweden, but back in the U.S., which is kind of laying the psychological groundwork for her situation, is crucial and really well handled by not only Pugh in the performance, but Astor in the camera work, as you mentioned. And I think by making it personal, again, it makes it a more relevant form of spiritual warfare. I was doing some reading for this show and came across a section from a book called The Message of Spiritual Warfare. It's by Keith Ferdinando, and he writes, "Before it is the warfare of God's people, spiritual warfare is the warfare of God himself. Satan, sin, and the world are all expressions of cosmic rebellion against the Creator and his will and purposes, and God himself addresses that opposition and brings it to nothing." So in that context, when it's described that way, it's not so much that we are warriors on the front line. I think that's often how Christians think about it, is that we're bearing this load, we're fighting this battle. This is really, as everything, it's about God first. And so spiritual warfare for the daily Christian, I think, is more about when the cosmic sinful rebellion against God plays out in microcosm in our own hearts. And it seems to me that that's the sort of warfare going on here within Danny that we trace through the film. Do you think that journey is traced consistently through the movie, or does it fall off a bit? Because for me, that prologue sets it up so beautifully, and then we get a long, long stretch, especially when we start experiencing the rituals of the commune, where it kind of falls by the wayside in favor of these art installation segments of the grotesque. and then Aster comes back around in the final climactic horror to tie it into her psychological framework. But I think I like this a little less than Hereditary, because in the middle, for me, that interior spiritual warfare, that interior crisis gets set aside.
You know, I felt the same way the first time I watched it. The second time I watched it, again, in part having your piece for TC in mind, I see that actually in those earlier scenes. And so I don't know if this is too spoilery, but that first ritual in which two members of the commune who have reached the age of 72, which is the end of the life cycle for them, willingly, at least as far as we can tell, willingly walk to the edge of the cliff and one by one jump off the cliff to kill themselves. It's another bit of Aster's obsession with head trauma and faces being destroyed. But if you watch Danny through that situation, there's another shot, reverse shot, where the first woman goes up and she starts performing this activity, moving her body in a certain way, and she looks up, and then we get an overhead shot where she's looking up at us, and then she looks down. We cut to Danny looking up at her. She looks back, and then she does the jump. And the next person does a similar jump, but as you know, he doesn't die right away. And so he's writhing in pain. The people in the commune start shouting and moaning themselves to the point where it literally drowns out his pain in the soundtrack. But we keep cutting to Danny, who's seeing the face of her parents there. She sees the face of her parents, she sees her sister, and she's looking around, and it's clear she's calm in that moment, right? There's something that these people have figured out to her that tracks with her in a way that other people do not. And in my kind of grand theory of the movie is she eventually accepts the commune because at the very least, they've figured out how to handle death, control death in a way that she doesn't have before. And I feel like the film reveals that as horrific by the end because there is no empathy that happens along with it, or it's a very false sense of empathy. But we can at least see the appeal to her in a way that makes sense for all of the rituals, and I think even hints at some of our Christian rituals as ways of making sense of death.
That's a really rough scene, not only just for the graphic nature of it, but I think, yeah, for the challenging ways it makes us think about how we do handle death in the U.S. compared to what this commune has decided. But yeah, I can see the connection too. I mean, it's a literal one. We do get those flashbacks to Danny's family. And I think there's maybe one or two other moments like that where we return to her psychological state. So it's there. You're right. Ari Aster does make a few connections here and there, and maybe I should give those a little more weight than I did the first time around. When you think about this idea of the term spiritual warfare, warfare suggests conflict, right? And that suggests a winner and a loser. And you mentioned the ending. We don't want to get into spoilers, but maybe we can try to talk around it. It's very ambivalent. It could be read as, you know, a win or a loss for Danny. You started going this way, but where do you think things land for her, especially if we see this as some sort of spiritual conflict going on?
Yeah. I read it as a loss. I've read a lot of lovely pieces that see this as Danny clearing out the harmful presences out of her life and that it's a win, but I don't buy any of the supposed empathy. Every time the commune people try to emulate somebody's suffering. And I think this is intentional. The suffering person's screams literally get drowned out of the soundtrack by the people in the commune. There's a big scene where Danny's freaking out about something and the people in the commune start mimicking what she's doing. And they are literally holding her down, looking in her face and sort of walking her through the steps of how to grieve. And so the focus on her face at the end and the facial expression that she makes before the movie cuts to black, there's nobody else looking at her. There's nobody else giving back what she needs. She's just sort of taken into the commune and given up for this kind of false control over death. But there's still no love. There's no compassion. The things that she needs are not going to get met. Those human elements here in the commune, it's just a different way of avoiding and dehumanizing, at least in my reading.
Yeah, I think you're right. And there's a real cost, you know, for me too,
yes.
When you look at what this supposed triumph, because I think the movie wants to leave you wondering, but the filmmaking certainly pushes you towards reading it as a moment of triumph, at least at the end for her, of personal triumph and maybe some sort of spiritual awakening even. But the cost of that, you mentioned ridding her life of bad forces. That's a pretty drastic way to do that. What happens in the final moments of the film. So yeah, even though she may be in a better place without certain elements in her life, I don't know if the trade has been fair for where she is now. So this is maybe a risky question to ask given the bizarreness of this movie, but where else did your mind go during Midsommar, Joe? Is there anything else you wanted to bring up before we wrap up here?
Oh my goodness, so many places. I think it's a really beautiful movie in a lot of ways about the need for empathy. The one place that it went that I think is instructive for us as Christians is to think about the purposes behind our various rituals and our relationship to death. One of the criticisms that I've heard of Christianity throughout my life is that you just believe this because you're scared of death. And there certainly are readings and ways that we can interpret it that way. But I believe that what Jesus came to teach and what we follow is not deathward, even though sacrifice is absolutely part of it and giving oneself up is absolutely part of it, but it's lifeward. Even as Jesus faced his sacrifice, he's constantly looking back at the people around him and how he can serve and love them. And I believe that part of what Midsommar does, you know, it doesn't go far with the one main character being named Christian, but darn, it's there. And you got to do something with it. There's a little bit of a critique, I think, of our Western practices and our rituals. And for somebody who loves Christian rituals like I do, I think that's a good thing to remember, is that all of our rituals are not to save us from death. Rather, they are for spreading the life of the gospel to other people. And we can sometimes forget that. And I think Midsommar kind of is a helpful reminder for me in that level.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good challenge beyond the basic sort of horror that the movie makes us face. I think in some ways it's a good intellectual challenge as well. Well, you mentioned, Joe, a couple times, I did get a chance to write about this on the TC website. It's one of the benefits of being the editor. You know, if I really want to write about something, I just assign it to myself. So I do focus on this. It's really Astor's signature visual motif, I think, a character's open mouth gaping in horror. We see it with Toni Collette in Hereditary. She's kind of the mascot for that. And it's continued and amplified in Midsommar in some interesting ways. So that's at thinkchristian.net. If you want to dig into Midsommar some more, go ahead and check that out. Thank you, Joe. Wow, saw the movie twice. Really did your homework for this one. I appreciate it. I wish you sweet Midsommar dreams, or, you know, I guess maybe nightmares is, is what we're going to be facing now. We'll talk to you again, all right?
All right, thanks, Josh.
Will you partake of that last offered cup or disappear into the potter's ground? When the man comes around, hear the trumpets, hear the pipers, 100 million angels singing, multitudes are marching to the big kettle drum.
Spiritual warrior Johnny Cash there with "The Man Comes Around." That's maybe the closest thing we have to Cash doing an audio version of the Book of Revelation. Of course, the claim of Revelation is that whatever spiritual warfare you're experiencing, demons, dementia, remember that this is a battle that's already been won on our behalf. As Keith Matheson put it in an article at Ligonier.org, It is important for believers to understand that the outcome of this war is not uncertain. The decisive battle has already been won at the cross. Johnny Cash's The Man Comes Around is just one of the songs on the Spotify playlist that John J. Thompson put together to accompany this episode. Earlier, we heard The Clash's Should I Stay or Should I Go? That gave us some of that 80s Stranger Things vibe. In between picking perfect on-point songs for us, John has also started a new podcast of his own, True Tunes. It's a celebration of the good, the true, and the beautiful in music. John kicked that off with an interview with Charlie Peacock, so be sure to check that out. I want to thank Joe George and Claude Acho for joining me for this episode. Both have done a lot of good writing for us as well over at the website, thinkchristian.net. If you want to keep up with all the stuff that we publish there, because we get to a lot more than we're able to cover on the show, you can sign up to receive our emails at thinkchristian.net/subscribe. And to keep up with everything that's going on Think Christian-wise, you can always find us on Facebook and on Twitter. Just look for us at Think Christian. Don't forget those ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts. It really does make a difference. And if you have specific thoughts about the show that you want to send directly to me, I'm Josh Larson. Email me at jlarson@reframemedia.com. That's J-L-A-R-S-E-N. The Think Christian Podcast is a production of Reframe Media, a family of programs designed to help you see your whole life reframed by God's gospel story. Visit reframemedia.com for more info. Our executive producer is Stephen Koster. Our audio engineer and post-production supervisor is John Reeder. Lastly, a note of thanks to the Communication Arts Department at Trinity Christian College in Palos Heights, Illinois. They provided the recording space for this episode. Learn more at trnty.edu and go Trolls.